The construction of Cologne Cathedral was more than just building a place of worship. It was a huge building project that set European standards. A construction site that required craftsmanship, technical innovation, and the effort of hundreds of workers. I would like to give you a little insight into the working methods and technology of cathedral construction in the 13th century here, and spoiler, I can only give you a glimpse. The subject is so complex that I'm sure I've left out or forgotten a lot here. And more about this right after the intro. The construction of today's Cologne Cathedral was a centuries-long project. In this episode, we take a brief, incomplete look at how such a mega-project was tackled, all without computers, complete construction drawings, or modern machinery. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a kind of microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows, from the Romans up until our present time. What were the technical foundations of cathedral construction at that time? The Roman legacy and the experience of the Romanesque architectural style during the Middle Ages had a lasting impact on European architecture. While a Germanic wooden house in antiquity could often be built with just four simple tools, axe, chisel, wedge, and a knife, Roman masonry construction once involved much more complex and resource-intensive techniques. This construction method, already adopted in late antiquity, created the decisive technical prerequisites for the erection of enormous structures north of the Alps. The whole thing was continually improved and refined during the Romanesque period, so that sometimes it is not entirely clear whether this or that building is late Rhenish Romanesque or already Gothic. Another prerequisite for these large-scale construction projects were economically stable times, favored by warmer climate and improved farming methods. When the question arose as to whether a building should be renovated or rebuilt, the decision was often made in favor of new construction, as Cologne impressively demonstrated in 1248 when the prestigious old Cologne Cathedral was demolished without acute necessity. Between 1100 and 1300, around 28 new church buildings were constructed in Cologne alone, not even counting numerous conversions and extensions. Churches are considered to be the most important works of medieval architecture, and this is undisputed, whether you're a believer or not. Even with advanced farming methods, agricultural surpluses remained low and resources for large building projects such as cathedrals were scarce. However, this changed with the prolonged warm period and the growing money economy, which encouraged an early form of capitalism and thus also drove the construction of magnificent cathedrals. Cologne Cathedral is an apt example. It relied primarily on donations from pilgrims to help finance its construction. These economic developments made it possible to tackle larger and more ambitious building projects than ever before in the 13th century. If the feudal system, for example, had been adhered to for the construction of the cathedrals and mainly inexperienced servants had been used who were subservient to their masters, a comparable building would hardly have been possible. Architecture and statics do not forgive even the smallest mistakes. The result would have been the collapse of the building. In addition, serf labor or poorly paid work rarely leads to the dedication and diligence that an ambitious project like a cathedral requires. What's more, the serfs could hardly devote the necessary time as they were responsible for their own fields and they lacked the specialized knowledge and experience required for such complex architectural projects. At most, they could have assisted with logistics or the procurement of raw materials. So, a decisive step on the way to buildings such as Cologne cathedrals in Europe during the Middle Ages was therefore the emergence of specialized trades and the remuneration in money for auxiliary workers such as porters. These skilled workers, including blacksmiths, stonemasons, and carpenters, worked together in their respective professions and formed the basis for the enormous technical achievements of cathedral construction. They did nothing else, and unlike around 95% of the population at that time, did not have to focus mainly on agriculture, just like most of us don't have to do this in the 21st century. Let's first take a look at the people who worked on the construction site. We don't know the exact number of workers at Cologne Cathedral. There were probably a few dozen to perhaps around hundreds, but no more than that. Above all, it depends on the time of year. In winter or at harvest time, many of the unskilled workers were absent because they were either working the fields or the weather did not permit major work. Then, as now, the master builder was at the head of the construction work, often referred to in Latin as architectus or magister operis in historical sources. However, the word architectus should not mislead us and should be translated directly as the modern word architect. The cathedral master builder is more than just an architect. He almost always comes from a craftsman background, usually a stonemason and or bricklayer, plans the construction and also carries it out, supervises staff, manages the costs and organizes the building materials. The men who worked on a construction site, such as Cologne Cathedral, were considered the best master builders of their time, as cathedrals were the royal form of architecture. Master cathedral builders were often recruited from abroad and traveled wildly from site to site during the course of their careers. All of their knowledge was not based on a written body of knowledge, but was the result of years of practical training, trial and error, and the resulting experience. The training period to become a master builder was lengthy and went through three phases. Phase 1. Bricklaying and stonemasonry apprenticeships usually lasted at least 5 years. Training began at the age of 14. Once you had successfully mastered this, you were 19 years old. Phase 2. The apprentice then went on tour for at least a year and worked on construction sites to gain further practical experience, but also as a means of further training to learn other methods and techniques elsewhere. Phase 3. Once this was also completed and you had proven yourself capable, another 2 to 3 years followed. Sculpture, drawing, geometry, and architecture were taught here. Only from then on, with a lot of skill and a pinch of luck, were you a master builder, and in your mid to late 20s or even early 30s, you are now a master builder. Like today's star architects, these master builders were respected in the places where they worked. They were part of the city's high society. Nevertheless, being a master builder was hard work. There wasn't much free time for cocktail parties. Of course, there were a few amenities in return. We also know that master builder Gerhard, the first master builder of Cologne Cathedral, had a stone house built at a good address in Cologne. All of this was only possible with the appropriate financial means and prestige in the city society. Although highly skilled craftsmen, their high status often meant that master builders were no longer directly involved in the construction work, but were responsible for organizing and keeping an eye on the big picture. They would pass on work orders to the craftsmen, check individual work steps, and so on. The greatest construction work in terms of time and load was of course carried out by the construction workers on the building site. How many of them were there? Can only be estimated for Cologne Cathedral, perhaps 50 to 80. In any case, no more than 100. Nor did the workers work all year round. The number of construction workers was particularly thin between July and September. They had to go on the surrounding fields and bring in the harvest. Likewise, in winter, the building site was largely dormant, with only the stonemasons continuing to cut stones in huts or shelters. When it got warmer again, in springs, the stones were ready to be moved into place by the construction workers. It is extremely difficult to estimate the wages of construction workers in the Middle Ages. The standard of living at that time, the needs, and the purchasing power are not comparable to today. Stonemasons would probably have earned the most among the skilled trades. At the bottom of the wage pyramid was the day laborer as a porter. How did the construction workers generally view their working conditions? Did they find the job strenuous or even too dangerous? And did they also see it as a grievance of their time, so that they sometimes wanted to revolt against it, like the factory workers of the 19th and 20th century, and waving a red flag? The answer to the question can be abbreviated: no. They did not see the working conditions as bad. With a steady salary and a deeply religious worldview, these questions did not arise. Of course, as is typical of humans, there was certainly friction at work, arguments, stupid bosses, or conversely, lazy colleagues. But when disputes arose, the question of the system was not raised at some point. God had put people in their place, at least in those days, this was not questioned. But one thing is certain. For conclusive judgment, we simply lack sufficient availability of historical sources for ordinary construction workers. What do you need when building something? Whether in the Stone Age, Antiquity, the Middle Ages, or today? Energy. And a lot of it. Nowadays, this energy is provided not only by people, but above all by technical machines, driven by combustion engines, electric motors, hydraulics, and whatever else there is. Until well into the 19th century, however, we only had two main sources of energy on a construction site: human and animal energy sources in the form of muscle power. If you look at pictures of construction sites in the media these days, you often see images of big moments during constructions, the topping out ceremony is shown, a large component is installed, or even the building is inaugurated with a red ribbon by officials. In late medieval depictions, or even documentaries, however, we see something similar. Large stone blocks are moved or raised upwards, but this is not the everyday work. However, what I found most interesting during my research, the greatest energy requirement is not when moving the building block into the correct gap on site, no, it is the transportation of the material and the logistics that take up the most space. Felling a tree in a forest, rather in the outskirts of Cologne or wherever, then transporting it to the construction site for the cathedral requires many times more energy than processing the tree trunk on site to make something out of it, like scaffolding, for example. The same applies to all other building materials. Stones from the quarry, sand and gravel from a pit, all of this has to be hauled to the cathedral construction site, an aspect that I personally am not always directly aware of. Of course, water power can be used to a certain extent. Clearly, without the Rhine River, such a cathedral, a large cathedral, would hardly have been possible. For example, when stones or trees were transported across the Rhine to Cologne. But from the harbor basin onwards, it was again up to men and animals to transport the material up to the cathedral construction site. Even today, some street names bear witness to this enormous logistical challenge of the time. For example, the Trankgasse, the drinking alley, runs north of the cathedral. The Trankgasse, because the numerous drought animals such as horses and oxen were fed there, and there were countless drinking troughs, it was really a logistical challenge, even feeding the animals. Feed and water had to be constantly provided here. The cool thing is that the medieval Trankgasse, the drinking alley, is now below today's modern street level. You can see a section of the cobbled street in the archaeological excavation zone under Cologne Cathedral. In the early Middle Ages, a better harness had been developed for horses, which meant that the animal could pull three times as much as before. This also made larger construction projects such as the cathedral even possible. Large blocks of stone were actually transported using rollers or sledges. However, most blocks of stones were shot in such a way that one or more people could carry them for a short period of time until they had loaded them onto a cart or a horse or a ship. Where did the stones for Cologne Cathedral come from? For example, around 50 kilometers up the Rhine at Drachenfels, south of Cologne. Drachenfels, German meaning dragon stone. Already the ancient Romans had used that quarry for their own purposes in antiquity, a place near today's Bonn. The stones were carried down the slope of the mountain and then transported by ship or raft across the Rhine to Cologne, with lasting consequences. The entire mountain threatened to collapse several times in the 20th century, and even more recently, concrete and steel were used to shore up the Drachenfels mountain. Today, It is a wonderful and safe excursion destination. Once the building materials had arrived at the construction site, as I said, most of the energy required had already been used. Even having a stonemason cut a stone into shape on site or cutting or sawing wood did not come close to this. Once the building material was finished and ready to be moved into the building under construction, the task was to move it to the right place and, if necessary, to the right height. Pure human muscle power was mainly used for this. Workers strapped wooden barrels, baskets or planks to their backs to transport mortar or small stones, for example. In the course of the 14th century, or perhaps not until the 15th century, a huge wooden crane was placed on the southern of the two towers foundations of Cologne Cathedral, which was a technical masterpiece for its time. Completely without hydraulics, this 25-meter-high crane could lift stones weighing up to 2 tons. But as I said, the same applies here. Most of the work was done by muscle power. Wooden ramps, ladders, and scaffolding were used to climb to the top. As far as the obvious pulley block is concerned, my literature at least says that it wasn't even that common on construction sites, and that surprises me because many late medieval townhouses in Cologne had pulleys attached to their facades to hoist goods from the street to the upper floors. If you know more about that topic, please let me know. The crane was preserved until 1868 and adorned the cathedral construction site as the city's real landmark. In its 500-year existence, however, it was probably only in use for a few decades at the beginning. There are some really beautiful paintings and photographs of it. I'll put them on the homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. What existed, of course, were the so-called hamster wheels, cranes that could be operated by running wheels with one or more workers who moved around in them to transport the loads upwards, like in an elevator. On 15th of August 1248, the feast day of the Assumption of Mary, Archbishop Konrad of Hochstaden laid the foundation stone for the new Cologne Cathedral. However, I was unable to find out where the foundation stone is today. It would probably no longer be recognizable as such. One theory says that it was laid exactly where his current grave, that of Konrad of Hochstaden, is located. However, there is no proof of this. Some documents and literature make the laying of the foundation stone by the archbishop a sovereign task of the archbishopric. However, this is not true. The client was the cathedral chapter, not the Archbishop of Cologne. This means that the cathedral is effectively its own builder, and that is still the case today. The cathedral does not belong to the archbishopric, nor the Vatican, nor to the state, but simply to itself. How exactly did the construction work proceed? We can understand that reasonably well, especially through the archaeological excavations that were carried out under the cathedral in the 20th century and continue to this day. It has always been the same with a classic new stone building. The ground is excavated to lay a foundation. Nowadays, concrete is poured. But in the Middle Ages, a mixture of different types and sizes of stone was used. In the Middle Ages, and until the invention of modern building calculations, the calculation was quite simple. The foundation had to be just as heavy as the building on the surface. This ensured that the building could not collapse under its own weight. Master builder Gerhard has his workers dig 10 meters deep, sometimes even 60 meters, to lay the foundations in the excavated space, which will one day support 120,000 tons of building on the surface. Almost the same number of tons will be used as foundations below ground. Anyone with a little knowledge of statistics and architecture will know that this is far too overambitious from today's perspective. Nevertheless, it was a clever move by master builder Gerhard due to the lack of calculation methods which only emerged in the course of the 19th century. People in the Middle Ages and long afterwards always played it safe and built the foundations oversized. There were two challenges here. The sandy soil due to the proximity to the Rhine River and the fact that they were not building on the green fields. They were building in the middle of the city, and the foundations of the old Cologne Cathedral were located here, as were those of the late antique Bishop's Church and other Roman buildings. Here the builders managed to make the best possible use of the narrow space when constructing the foundations. For cost reasons and to avoid additional work, only as much of the historical building fabric underground was demolished as was necessary. This can also be seen in today's archaeological excavation zone under the cathedral and makes the place an El Dorado for history and archaeology enthusiasts who are very happy about it. With a few exceptions, the entire foundation walls of the predecessor building of Cologne Cathedral, for example, still exist, partly with floors and floor tiles, Roman house walls with wall paint as well. If you should ever see the foundations and are a layman like me in this field, you should be aware that Master Gerhard created a masterpiece with the foundation of today's cathedral alone. Many basalt stones were used, one of the hardest types of stones there is. That's good, because they have to bear all the weight above. But using only this hard stone would not be good either. A large building should not be rigid, as we know all too well from today's skyscrapers. Of course, people knew that back then too. That's why the master builder had his workers lay tuff and mortar in between the hard basalt. Tuff is a softer type of stone. In this way, the cathedral would, God forbid, even survive a moderate earthquake unscathed. As a result, the foundation is both stable and flexible, just like today's reinforced concrete buildings. Once the foundations had been laid, how did you actually start building on the surface in the fresh air? Work on Cologne Cathedral began on the so-called choir, the eastern part of the cathedral. Remember, they had originally only wanted to demolish the previous building in the east, and the old cathedral continued to exist in the west for quite some time and was still being used for church services, pilgrims, and everything else during the construction work in the east. The semicircular choir at the eastern end facing the Rhine was the start of this. First, a small test building was erected on the southern side of the choir loft to be built. As it was not possible to calculate the statistics, a test piece was built, a mini segment, so to speak, with rising masonry to see whether the whole thing would hold here at all. The test construction site was probably successful because they quickly moved on to the actual construction. The choir was built from the outside in and from the bottom up. Why this part of the building first? The choir was always built facing east. Roughly speaking, the Holy Jerusalem also faces in this direction. The choir, therefore, not only served as liturgical center, but also as the most sacred part of the building, which was to be complete first in order to make the church usable as quickly as possible. The work was carried out according to a clear plan. The building sections were realized in symmetrical mirroring sections, which perfectly reflected the Gothic architectural style. The style emphasized the vertical structure and was intended to create not only stability, but also visual lightness. The main building was probably started in the south of the choir to be built, exactly where the test building had previously been erected. Once the first story of the outer wall and buttress on the south side had been completed, they moved to the directly opposite side to the north and repeated the same construction process in mirror image. Once this was finished, they went back to the south side and built the next story. Once this was finished, you went to the northern side and repeated the process. Once this was finished, you went back to the... I think you understand what I mean. I post the corresponding sketches on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com, for better clarification. Inside, directly adjacent to the outer walls, there were several niches that were to be used as chapels when pilgrims passed through in a semicircular circuit, just as the many visitors do today. The choir chapels were not built one after the other, as is often assumed. Instead, the entire outer wall was first erected below the windows, as described above, starting at the two western ends and working towards the chapel of St. John near the central axis. The outer buttresses were then placed towards the west, and the inner buttresses were added from the west towards the center. Starting from this central point, they began to complete the vault on both sides. The whole thing, this eastern end of today's Cologne Cathedral, must have progressed quite quickly and far since the foundation stone was laid in 1248, because Conrad von Hochstaden died in 1261 and had himself buried in one of the chapels of the Cologne Cathedral choir. You can still find him there today, but don't worry, we will encounter this archbishop a few more times in this podcast. In 1277, the choir building was probably already far advanced enough to fit an altar, but they played a trick here. It was a northern extension to the choir that was completed here, the sacristy. Architecturally somewhat simpler than the rest of the adjoining choir, it was completed more quickly. The altar was blessed by none other than our friend Albertus Magnus. Unfortunately, the altar consecrated by Albertus Magnus was demolished in 1868 when the cathedral was in the final stages of completion. In 1322, the choir was completed and the eastern part of the new cathedral was now fully usable for liturgical purposes. This was the final end for the remaining western part of the old Cologne Cathedral from the 19th century. The last remnant of the Romanesque church had now completely disappeared. And it must have made an interesting picture on the first day of the final demolition. Gothic choir with its partition wall to the west, packed directly against the much smaller old Romanesque cathedral. What we should also not forget here, and perhaps this is worth a podcast episode of its own, are the large and tall stained glass windows in the choir which were installed in the course of the 13th and 14th centuries. The early date of their creation also shows how quickly the construction of the choir progressed with just a few dozen workers and the limited skills available today. In 1260, 12 years after construction began, the first windows were installed. While nowadays many tourists turn their heads inside to see the Shrine of the Three Kings, my gaze wanders always to the so-called older Bible window, in which I can still find new elements every time I visit. Here you can see that the Middle Ages were not dark at all, but let's not open that barrel now. Many of the medieval windows have survived time, especially the Second World War, as they were removed in time and brought to safety. When the choir was finished of Cologne Cathedral, one could already imagine the splendor of the finished cathedral, a splendor that was also recorded by Francesco Petrarca, the Italian Renaissance historian, and he said, "I have seen the temple in the middle of the city, which is not without reason called the most glorious, very beautiful, but unfinished." End quote. Interesting, because Petrarch is the founder of the concept of the Middle Ages and is not really fond of it. He sees himself and the approaching future as a new age, a modern age, mourns what he sees as the great antiquity, and complains that he is living a transitional period, the so-called Middle Ages, which have existed since the end of Western Rome. However, the Italian was also interested in other things in the city. Quote, "The morals in this barbarian country are astonishing. The beauty of the city, the sedate demeanor of the men, the decorous behavior of the women." And he continued, "The entire shore was covered by a glittering crowd of women that could not be overlooked. If the heart had not already been bound, it could have been burned with love here." End quote. Dear people, we have now looked back to the early 14th century to see how the construction of Cologne Cathedral progressed. In this first construction phase, the eastern section was completed by 1322. The choir, as you can still see it today, was finished in that year. It is 43 meters high. This makes it much taller than later German monuments, for example. Incidentally, the Brandenburg Gate is only 26 meters high. No flex, just so that you have a comparison high to another German landmark, lest you think this is Berlin bashing. At 47 meters, the German Reichstag is a few meters taller than the choir of Cologne Cathedral. I would say we're done for today. It was once again very architectural, I know that. Next episode, we're going to dive deep into the history of events again, because there's trouble in the city again, here in Cologne in the middle of the 13th century. Will it get bloody or violent? Or can the conflict still be prevented? A small monk, we already know, will take to the big city stage. Stay tuned. Many thanks to my patrons for your continued support of this podcast, especially to BJ Becker as the newest member. Sorry, that's how you call yourself on Patreon. I hope that is correct. Thanks also to Norbert, Antje, Christian, Jonah and Sylvia for donating via PayPal. And as literature I used, Schichten und Geschichte unter dem Dom von Georg Hauser, Köln im Hochmittelalter von Hugo Stehkämper und Karl Dietmar, Geschichtliches und Baugeschichtliches zum Kölner Dom von Arnold Wolf, Kirchenbau im Mittelalter von Dietrich Konrad and many thanks to Cologne's City Museum to let me use their library so I can get all that information for you guys. So, recommend me further. Stay healthy. Recommend me further. Did I say that already? I have no idea. It's been a long week. And until next time, auf Wiedersehen.